Yet more and more often, they found only brittle young ice in their path, and they raced ahead, hardly even slowed by it. At 11:30 a.m. on January the 9th, they passed close to a berg so magnificent they gave it a name, the Rampart Berg. It towered 150 feet into the air, more than twice the height of the Endurance's mainmast. So close did they come to it that looking down into the indigo water, they saw it stretching away beneath them, 40 feet below the keel of the ship, and going ever deeper. 1,000 feet beneath them, Worsley estimated, becoming bluer and bluer until they could see it no more. And just beyond it was the dark, rolling, ice-free ocean stretching to the horizon. They were through the pack. "We feel," said Worsley, as pleased as Balboa when, having burst through the forest of the Isthmus of Darien, Panama, he beheld the Pacific. They set a course of south by east and ran at full speed for 100 carefree miles through open water, with whales sporting and blowing on all sides. At 5 p.m. on January the 10th, they sighted land, which Shackleton named the Caird Coast, in honour of the expedition's principal backer. By midnight, they were steaming west in the twilight, 500 feet off a succession of 1,000-foot ice cliffs, collectively termed the Barrier. The Endurance was now about 400 miles northeast of Vassal Bay, and Shackleton headed her in that direction. For 5 days they ran parallel with the Barrier, and their progress was excellent. By January the 15th, they were within 200 miles of Vassal Bay. At about 8 a.m. on the 16th, heavy pack was sighted ahead from the masthead. They reached it at 8:30 and saw that it was kept from moving by a number of giant bergs that were grounded on a shoal. They furled sail and proceeded under steam along the edge of the pack, looking for a way through. But none could be found. Toward noon the wind freshened from the east-northeast, and by mid-afternoon was blowing a gale. At 8 p.m., when they saw that no real progress could be made, they took shelter under the lee of a large grounded berg. The gale continued on the 17th, and even increased in intensity. Though the sky overhead was blue, clear, dense clouds of snow driven off the land filled the air. The Endurance dodged back and forth, keeping under the sheltering protection of the berg. The northeast gale began to moderate about 6 a.m. on January the 18th, so they set the topsail and proceeded south with the engines at slow. Most of the pack had blown away to the southwest, leaving only a small amount trapped by the stranded bergs. They made their way through it for about 10 miles, until at 3 p.m. they ran into the main body of the pack once more, stretching from the face of the barrier away to the northwest as far as could be seen. But dead ahead, the dark streak of a so-called water sky held promise of a large patch of open ocean. They decided to work through the pack, and the Endurance entered it at 5 p.m. Almost immediately, they realized that this was a different sort of ice from anything encountered before. The floes were thick but very soft and consisted mostly of snow. They floated in a soupy sea of mushy, brash ice composed of ground-up floes and lumps of snow. The mass of it closed in around the ship like pudding. At 7 p.m., Greenstreet headed the Endurance between two large floes toward a pool of open water. Halfway along, the ship got mired in the brash, and then another floe closed in behind her. Even with the engines at full speed ahead, it took her 2 hours to push her way through. What seemed like a routine decision was recorded in Worsley's log. "We therefore lie to for a while to see if the pack opens at all when this northeast wind ceases." But it was 6 cold, cloudy days, until on January the 24th, the northeasterly gale dropped off. By then, the ice was packed snugly around the Endurance in every direction as far as the eye could see. And Worsley wrote in his log, "We must possess ourselves in patience till a southerly gale occurs, or the ice opens of its own sweet will." But no southerly gale occurred, nor did the ice open of its own sweet will. At midnight on January the 24th, A crack 15 feet wide appeared about 50 yards ahead of the ship. By mid-morning, the crack was a quarter of a mile across. A full head of steam was raised, all sails set, and the engines put full speed ahead in an attempt to break through to the crack. For 3 hours, the ship leaned against the ice with all her might, and never moved a foot. The Endurance was beset. As Ord Lees, the storekeeper, put it, frozen, like an almond in the middle of a chocolate bar. Chapter 4. What had happened was simple enough. The northerly gale had compressed and crowded the whole Weddell Sea pack against the face of the land, and no force on earth could open up the ice again, except another gale from the opposite direction. But instead of southerly gales, there were only very moderate winds. Worsley's diary tells the story of day after day of waiting for the gale that never came. Light southwest breeze, moderate. Easterly breeze. Gentle southwest breeze. Calm and light airs. Light westerly breezes. It was a chance, a freak, a hard northerly gale, then quiet cold. Among the men, the realization that the Endurance was really beset for good came very slowly, like a kind of creeping resignation, a bad dream from which there was no waking. Anxiously they watched each day, but the face of the pack remained substantially unchanged. The story again was told in their diaries. Dour old Chippy McNeish, the carpenter, wrote at the end of the gale on January the 24th, "Still fast, and no sign of any opening. The pressure is still a serious business, and if we don't get out of it soon, I'll not give much chance of ever getting away from here." On the 25th, "Still fast. We tried to cut away the ice to relieve the ship, but it was no use." On the 26th, "Still fast. The water has opened out a bit ahead of us, but the flow we are in is still as sound as ever." The 27th, "Still fast. We had another trial to break the ice. Gave it up." The 28th. "Temperature 6 degrees. Very cold. Still fast, and no signs of any change." The 29th. "Still fast. No signs of any change." The 30th. "Still fast." The 31st. "Still fast." Nevertheless, full watches were maintained, and the ship's business was carried out as ever. On January the 31st, they made the first attempt to use their radio. It was a battery-powered affair, capable only of receiving spark transmission messages in Morse code. Its intended function was to pick up time checks for the chronometers and news programs which were to be broadcast to them on the first of each month from the Falkland Islands, now 1,650 miles away. In view of the distance to the transmitter, Hubert Hudson, the navigator, and Reginald James, the expedition's academic-minded young physicist, did all they could to increase the range of the set. They attached an extra 180 feet of wire to the antenna and soldered all the joints to improve the connections. At 3:20 the following morning, a small group of men gathered around the receiver in the wardroom. They fussed with the dials for more than an hour, but as everyone expected, all they heard was static. There was, in fact, a notable lack of interest in the radio, primarily because it was considered not only a novelty, but an unserviceable one. In 1914, radio was barely out of the infant stage, at least as far as long-distance reception was concerned. Nobody on board the Endurance expected very much of it, and they were neither surprised nor disappointed when their expectations were realized. Had the radio included a transmitter so that they could have broadcast news of their plight and position, the attitude of the crew might have been very different. Two or three times early in February, they tried to free the ship when cracks developed reasonably close to her, but these attempts failed completely. Then, on February the 14th, an excellent lead of water opened a quarter of a mile ahead of the ship. Steam was hurriedly raised, and all hands were ordered onto the ice with saws, chisels, picks, and any other tools that could be used to cut a lane through the floes. The Endurance lay in a pool of young ice only about a foot or two thick. This was systematically sawed and rafted away to give the ship room to batter at the floes ahead. The crew started work at 8:40 a.m. and worked throughout the day. By midnight, they had carved out a channel about 150 yards long. Early the next morning, the men resumed the effort, working more desperately to reach the lane of water before it closed. The ship was eased astern as far as she would go, then thrown full speed ahead toward the floes. A V-shaped slot had been sawed in the ice so that the bow of the ship might split the floe more easily. Again and again she slammed into the ice, throwing a wave of water up over the floe, then staggered and rolled and slipped backward. Each time she bit off a little more. The crew on the ice hurriedly threw wire hawsers around each chunk, some of them weighing more than 20 tons, and the Endurance, going full speed astern, dragged them back and away in preparation for another run. But she never had a really good crack at the floes ahead. There was always too much loose ice floating around her and freezing up. It slowed her repeated onslaughts and softened all her blows. At 3 p.m., after she had smashed one-third of the way through the 600-yard ice field leading to the open water, it was decided that the expenditure of coal and effort was useless. The remaining 400 yards of ice was 12 to 18 feet thick, and Shackleton, abandoning hope of getting through, ordered the fires let down. Still, the crew refused to give up, and during their watches turned out onto the ice to continue cutting away at it. Even frail Charlie Green, the cook, hurried through his bread-making to join his shipmates trying to saw the ship clear. But by midnight, the volunteers themselves could no longer deny the hopelessness of the task, and they returned to the ship. Green made hot porridge for all hands to warm them up before they turned in. The temperature was 2 degrees above zero. Greenstreet, always plain-spoken and never one to dodge the issue, summed up the general feeling in his diary that night. In a tired hand, he wrote, "Anyway, if we do get jammed here for the winter, we shall have the satisfaction of knowing that we did our darnest to try and get out." Their time was running out. They noticed the approaching end of the Antarctic summer on February the 17th, when the sun, which had shone 24 hours a day for 2 months, dipped beneath the horizon for the first time at midnight. At last, on February the 24th, Shackleton admitted that the possibility of getting free could no longer be seriously considered. The sea watches were cancelled, and a system of night watchmen was instituted. Shackleton's order merely made official what long before they had all come to accept. They would have to winter on board the ship, with whatever that might bring. Word of Shackleton's decision was passed along routinely by Wilde, and if anything, it was almost welcome. The end of sea watches meant that at least the men could sleep all night. For Shackleton, however, it was another matter. He was tormented by thoughts, both of what had happened and of what might happen. Hindsight now told him that if he had landed the transcontinental party on one of the places they had passed along the barrier, they would at least have been ashore, ready to strike out for the pole the next spring. But no one could have foreseen the disastrous chain of events that had brought them to their present predicament. Unseasonable northerly gales, then calms and sub-zero temperatures. Nor was there now any chance of landing the party that was to cross the continent. The drift of the pack since the Endurance was beset had carried them to within about 60 miles of Vasil Bay, a tantalizingly short distance, it would seem. But 60 miles over hummocky ice, with God knows how many impassable tracks of open water in between, carrying at least a year's supply of rations and equipment, plus the lumber for a hut, and all this behind sledges drawn by ill-conditioned and untrained dogs. No, 60 miles could be a very long way indeed. Even had there been no obstacle to putting the transcontinental party ashore, this was hardly the time for the leader of an expedition to forsake his ship and leave others to see her through, assuming she would get through. She would drift, to the west probably, under the prevailing winds and currents. But how far, and to where, and what would happen when the breakup came in the spring? Clearly, Shackleton's duty lay aboard the Endurance. But that realization did not lessen the bitterness of the fact that the Imperial Transantarctic Expedition's chances of succeeding, while always uncertain,